From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This weekend, the Group of 20 Nations, or G20, will descend upon the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires, for its annual summit. We go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, to discuss what this could mean for Argentina and the Latin America Caribbean region in general.
The G20 starts on, I think it's on November the 30th, the end of this week.
Right, Friday.
It runs over the weekend, December the 1st. And although Argentina and its government have been projecting it as a summit that will enable the Latin American region, they don't even mention the Caribbean. So they talk about Latin America being able to project itself via this G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, but and the utter insincerity of that is absolutely clear from the fact that they were the ones who scheduled the date, and right. They scheduled it on a day that Mexico is handing over its presidency. So
yeah.
Mexico, who's a member of the G20, will not be represented at the highest level. So that shows you how sincere Argentina is about projecting Latin America.
And it's a major difference. You know, this handover is a change in direction, you know, chosen by the electorate of Mexico for Mexico.
Yeah, of course.
You know, for Mexico.
And I don't know if Argentina fixed the date after the election result. I suspect that they must have, because it's just inconceivable that well-meaning, well-intentioned host of such an important meeting of some of the world's most important economies would schedule it in a way that left out kind of the second most important economy in Latin America, which is Mexico.
Well, it's exactly a year to the day after Argentina assumed the presidency, when Macri assumed it. That was November 30th, 2017, at Kirchner Center in Buenos Aires.
Right. So anyway, however that may be, and the fact is Mexico isn't going to be there. So right. It's absurd for Argentina, or not, at the highest level. I mean, obviously they'll have some representation, but it won't be a representation that carries the importance of
right.
The Mexican president, whether it's a right-wing or a left-wing president.
Right.
In this case,
right.
The importance of having the Mexican president would be that they would, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the new Mexican president, however progressive he may be, and he's definitely going to be more progressive and more nationalist in his policies than Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president. But he's definitely not somebody who naturally feels at home projecting neoliberal ideas. And he got elected on the basis that he'd change Mexico in a way that reflects the needs and aspirations of people at grassroots. And that was essentially his appeal. And that's why he and his Moreno movement had such a categorical win during those elections, which included not just the presidential elections, but also the legislative elections.
Right.
And his Moreno party got a significant majority in Mexico's parliament. Now, we'll just have to see how things progress in Mexico's internal affairs, and whether Andrés Manuel López Obrador can maintain some momentum against the massive forces of reaction that are going to be working against him, and also whether he'll be able to maintain the unity of his the deputies, the Moreno deputies in Mexico's National Assembly, and so that he will be able to get through his legislative program. All that remains to be seen. But and the symbolic importance of somebody who came to power on that agenda, an agenda that was specifically and explicitly in favor of meeting the needs and aspirations of ordinary people in Mexico, that goes completely against the current neoliberal ideology that dominates the G20. I mean, if you look at the G20, there are the G20 are a bunch of countries, but the 20th is the European Union that is a member as itself. And there are also European countries like Spain, I think, is a member, France, Germany, the United Kingdom. And what have those countries done in Europe? I mean, you just have to look at Greece. Look what they've crucified Greece. The policies that they promote in the European Union are policies of austerity and essentially extremely repressive policies, not just in economic terms, but also in social terms. It's people forget that there's been a state of siege in France for over a year.
Yep.
Right? And people forget that because the European Union pipes up at every opportunity talking about democracy and liberty and all that stuff.
Yeah, right.
And one of its leading members, France, had a state of siege for over a year.
That's amazing.
So, you know, when are they going to give us a break from all this democracy and freedom nonsense? Well, anyway, so going into the G20, it's no surprise at all that Mauricio Macri, who is somebody that's characterized by kind of an infatuation, a totally irrational infatuation with the kind of the policies that come out of Europe and out of North America that have nothing to do, that they're the direct opposite of what Andrés Manuel López Obrador stands for, or at least at the moment he stands for, and which is meeting people, the needs of ordinary people, and focusing on the needs of the human person. And that is absolutely fundamental in terms of, you know, if there's a dividing line between the progressive governments in Latin America and governments that aren't progressive, reactionary right-wing governments, the dividing line is, are their policies focused on the needs of the human person, or are their policies focused on the corporate profit?
Right.
And that's, you know, that's an absolutely fundamental division. Of course, there are several others, but that's one of the fundamental ones.
That's the fundamental one, really.
And so what have you got at the G20? You've got a bunch of countries coming from a position like Mauricio Macri, where they argue, and this is something that you've commented on several times, they argue that the economic success will come from free market policies and promoting the corporate investment and so on and so on. But their policies have completely failed in practice wherever you look. Now you've corrected me quite rightly in the past, where you say, well, of course those policies haven't failed because they're not designed to work,
right?
And so in one sense I'm right in that these policies have failed for what they're ostensibly supposed to do.
They fail the people, they fail the society.
That was meant to happen,
right? That's right.
As you point out,
right.
So, and the person, I think you're more right than I am.
Well, no, like this. I leave the house to run down to the corner deli to buy cigarettes or whatever, and then come back. And when I come back, my wife asks me, "Were you successful?" Well, I got robbed. I got banged in the head. That's why it took me 2 hours. I passed out. They stole my wallet. They found the car keys. They stole the car. And they have my wallet so they can come back here and rob everything. So I failed, but they were successful.
Right.
That's how it works.
So, yeah. Right. So, and that's not a bad analogy for the G20. You've got
no kidding.
These, these looters and robbers,
right,
congregating in Buenos Aires from North America and Europe.
Yep.
And they're meeting up with countries like Russia and China, and whatever you think about Russia's ideology, if it has one, and it's certainly in the case of China, you're talking about a country that is focused on the needs of people.
Yep.
There's no argument about that. I mean, they've lived. Western economists often say, have said over recent years, oh, look how good globalization is. It's lifted all these people out of poverty. Well, the great majority of them have been lifted out of poverty by Chinese in China,
right,
because
right.
of China's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
And it's got nothing to do with globalization. It's got to do with China's domestic policy being focused on the needs of its people.
Right.
So
that's right.
All these arguments are going to turn up in the G20 meeting, but they'll very likely be suppressed. But the important underlying currents in the G20? Well, the most obvious one, of course, is the role precisely of China, its infrastructure investment, its technology exchange, the way that it relates to people, and there's a genuine exchange of technology. And just look at the exchange of technology that's taken place in Venezuela, where Venezuelans now operate their satellites. I think they've got three satellites.
Yep.
That were built and launched by China. And it's Venezuelans that are operating them. Why? Because China trained them. So you've got exchange of technology, infrastructure investment that we talked about so many times in recent conversations, in particular the transcontinental railroad from the Peru's Pacific coast across to Brazil's southern Atlantic coast.
Right.
And you've got the trade openness, China's commitment to trading, which, you know, I'm sure that there are all kinds of arguments about, you know, who benefits more, but because China exports and tends to import raw materials, but one of the things that people can expect from increasing Chinese investment over the next few years is that Latin America's continuing dependence on export of raw materials, in the case of Argentina and Brazil, for example, soy and beef, in the case of Chile and Bolivia and Peru, minerals, in the case of Venezuela and Colombia, hydrocarbons, oil and gas, and Latin America can expect a result of Chinese influence and their growing exchange with China, their dependence on that raw material exports will progressively diminish as they get the benefit of technology exchange from China, as we've seen in Venezuela.
As they build capital too, you know, that's one of the things too. Like the idea of win-win is that you don't leave the other side impoverished, but rather enriched.
Yeah, and that's happening in Africa too.
Yep.
So, and you contrast that with the kind of what I call the do what we want or else diplomacy of the
right.
United States, the kind
right.
of gangster diplomacy of the United States.
Yep.
Now, and if you look, I mean, if you take Nicaragua's case or Central America in general, if you look at what does the United States do to benefit those countries' economies? Well, very little. And the main programs that it has that are genuinely beneficial to those economies have to do with agricultural extension, improving seed technology, and that kind of thing. Well, look at the United States. It's a country of 300 million people. Look at how powerful it is and what it could do in terms of transforming infrastructure and so forth, like China does. But it doesn't. And If you look at the United States Development Assistance Programs, they're like Taiwan. Taiwan does that. Taiwan does seed technology and that kind of agricultural extension stuff. So for the fact that that is the main benefit that Central American countries get from United States technical cooperation for development is pathetic. You know, there's no other word for it.
Yep.
And then the rest of U.S. Development cooperation is interventionist. Yep. You know, democracy programs and co-opting judicial and criminal justice systems. That's what the rest of United States government cooperation funding does.
That's right.
So you've got, on the one hand, you've got China coming up with multi-billion dollar in infrastructure investment, win-win trade proposals, technology exchange that enables countries like Venezuela to operate its own satellites and so forth. Right. And then on the other hand, you've got the United States saying, well, we can improve a few seeds for you.
Right.
You know, and it's just pathetic. And what do United States diplomats think? Do they think that people can't see that? Do they think that people in Latin America, you know, are totally stupid and don't understand that? Of course they understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, from the United States point of view, it's so important for them to co-opt judicial systems, because so as to lock up and make it impossible for progressive politicians to run for office like they've done to Lula, like they're trying to do to Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, like they're trying to do to Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and so on. So the political options for the United States and their allies, and although they're in the ascendant at the moment, their political options are narrowing all the time. The window is closing for them as China increases its influence, and as the G20 neoliberal policies fail on their own terms in Latin America and elsewhere,
right,
also get challenged by China and Russia in particular.
Well, there was an indigenous challenge in Argentina to this also this year. You had last week, on the 20th, I think it was last Tuesday, it started, in Buenos Aires, in Caballito. There was organized by Cristina de Kirchner and Dilma Rousseff, the first World Critical Thinking Forum.
Right.
And they had all of the, you know, the folks that Mujica, a whole bunch of folks were there. Bolivia's vice president. There was the guy from Monedero from Podemos, former Colombian president Ernesto Samper, and a bunch of others. And you know, they're basically organizing an international, you know, shadow counter response. In other words, you point out before, there's one of two paths that get followed by these governments and the institutions that spawn and support them. You know, one is to serve the needs of the people. The other is to serve the needs of a very small elite. The G20 generally has historically served the elite. There's a response coming from the grassroots, basically. And I'm hoping we're going to see that develop further over the next few years, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. And I'm optimistic that we'll see that develop, despite U.S. attempts to derail normal political processes in Latin America and the Caribbean. I mean, one interesting thing you touched on there is the changing role of Brazil and Argentina over the last few years. Because if you look at what Lula da Silva did and Dilma Rousseff did in Brazil, and what the Kirchners, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her her now deceased husband, Nestor. Right. What they did for Brazil and Argentina was project those nations onto the world stage as progressive forces, proactive forces, forces that were trying to meet the needs of their people, but at the same time, understanding that they could only do that by changing the international structures in which those nations are forced to operate, and kind of cut themselves out of the straitjacket that had been imposed by the dominance of the United States and its allies like Japan and the European Union. That, for example, and one of the things that happened in between 2006 and 2010, 2011, was the opening up of the IMF and the paradoxical situation in which you had, as a direct result of the global financial crisis provoked by the collapse of United States and European financial capitalism, and their inability to keep their kind of bubble economy under control through 2007, 2008, 2009. And that led to the United States. I think it was in fact George Bush that called the first recent, the resurgence of the G20 rather than the G7. And when was it that the G20 took over the G7? I think it was towards the end of the George Bush presidency. When was that? Around 2008? So I think that's right. And so at the time, what they were trying to do was kind of spread the blame spread the burden of their failure onto the G20 because their system failed to do what they said it would do, and so they kind of spread the blame onto a bunch of other countries.
Well, next year is 20 years because it was the G20 was founded in 1999.
Right.
So there's that on the waning years of Clinton.
But I don't think it really, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but as I remember, it really came to the fore around the 2008 crisis. And that was, paradoxically, that was when the IMF came, they kind of revived it. It had been a zombie.
Yeah. That's right.
In the years up until 2008. And I think they capitalized it with, what was it, however many million dollars it was. And they capitalized the IMF again, and the IMF began to play a key role in the neoliberal, in inverted commas, recovery from the 2008 crisis. Yeah. Because, and as far as I can see, we're still suffering the effects of that crisis. And so you've got this changed role of Brazil and Argentina. Back then, Brazil and Argentina were saying, well, look, we can do all these different things to kind of mitigate the crisis and do better. And they were very much arguing against the flow. They were against the current of opinion in the G20, obviously. But at least they were there playing that role. And then with the departure of Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff, and the assumption of power in Brazil by the usurper government of Michel Temer, and with the election of Mauricio Macri in Argentina in 2015 on a totally fraudulent electoral program, very similar to Lenin Moreno in Ecuador, Brazil and Argentina, kind of their roles flipped. And they became, instead of kind of making all kinds of proposals and being proactive about, these are things we can do to mitigate the crisis and defend people's basic, address the basic people's basic needs. And instead of that, you now have two governments under Temer. It's going to be worse under Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
Under Temer and Macri, who just string along with whatever they're told by their corporate masters in North America and Europe. And so and that's another thing that's somewhat awkward for Latin America in terms of this G20 meeting. The fact that the Brazilian president representing that very important country, not just in Latin America but in at a world level, will be somebody who's on their way out. Bolsonaro, I think he was invited by Macri, but chose not to go. And there's an indication that Bolsonaro, and one of the things that China will be arguing for at this G20 is against protectionism. It'll be trying to make the case to sustain the kind of open trading philosophy that has served it so well in recent years against the protectionism of Donald Trump and his administration, but it looks as though Bolsonaro is on Trump's side. Another keynote thing that's going to be influencing the development of the Congress will be the fact that while Russia and China are working together an increasingly consolidated way to consolidate their economic plans for Eurasia, their neighbors are finding extremely convincing, much more convincing than the kinds of proposals that are coming out of the United States, for example. While Russia and China are building that very, very strong consolidated Eurasian bloc, you've got the United States squabbling and bickering with the European Union over whether or not to, the European Union's trying to maintain relations with Iran at a time when the United States is trying to impose yet more sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy behavior coming out. But one of the things also, we're coming down to like 3-4 minutes left. One of the things that supposedly is on a fast track for some settlement is the trade dispute between the U.S. and China. I was watching some of the backstory stuff today on reading some things and listening to some of the people inside the administration that had cameras pointed at them. They're like, well, we're either going to settle this or we're going to settle it. In other words, it's either going to be fixed or game on. So coming out next week, the posture of the U.S. vis-a-vis China and vice versa probably will be known to most people, for at least for the short or medium term. And a lot of the other things then, they're going to shake out. They'll have an opportunity to shake out around that, including the relationship of, say, Brazil as one of the BRICS members to the BRICS group. And Argentina, Brazil, Mexico. All these, like Mexico being in flux, as you mentioned before, we have a big changeover coming, the day this opens next Friday, this Friday. So, a lot of balls up in the air, and some of them are going to start hitting the ground soon.
And something else to note is that it seems to me that the United States is very much on the defensive diplomatically, because if you look at the program of President Xi, and he's before he goes to the G20, I'm not sure. I think he's visiting Spain and Portugal first, and he's also going to visit Panama, which has broken off with Taiwan in favor of opening diplomatic relations with China. So President Xi will be visiting two important members of the European Union. He'll be visiting a country that's supposedly an ally of the United States, but has opted to dump Taiwan in favor of China. And then he'll be going to Argentina for the G20. But I think he's also planning to be at the presidential inauguration on December 1st of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. That's actually quite interesting. 20 heads of state will be participating in that, whereas only 3 heads of state turned up to the Ibero-American summit a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So I think it's really significant that Mexico, although it's not going to be represented at the highest level of the G20. It's going to be a very important player there, but by its in its absence.
All we can do is wait, watch, and see. So we're going to do that, and we appreciate your time. All right, Tony, thank you for your time. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next week.
Same. Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.